Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Today our program is, Can You Do Good and Defeat Evil Without Power? Author Bill Wong says, Your power is already in you. Now that you know, it's up to you to believe and wield it on behalf of the powerless. Bill served as a senior political advisor, chief of staff and legislative director to numerous Californian assembly members, and a state senator as well. Bill has advised nonprofits, labor organizations, and Fortune 100 companies. This month is also Asian American and Pacific Islander Month. So, Bill, thank you for being our guest today and also helping us celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander Month. Welcome to Be Bold America.
Hi, Jill. So great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So, Bill, at the beginning of your book, you asked, I thought, a really terrific question. And you asked, if I needed to raise a warrior, where would I start? Tell us how that question even came to mind, and how did you start answering it for yourself?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I was boarding a plane with a colleague of mine who was a labor lobbyist. She and her partner had just had a baby, and I can't remember how far back it was, but it was when we were just losing kind of faith in the political world and democracy, and she was terrified about bringing this child into the world, and she just kind of said, well, you know, how am I supposed to raise this child in this world?
Yes.
And I paused for a minute, and then that's when I said, well, I think you have to raise a warrior. So that's how that kind of came forward.
And what do you mean by that? To raise a warrior.
I think the world needs champions. We can't wait around for, you know, Superman to show up. I think that, you know, we are our own hero, and I think that it's about we get kind of and we've had you know, many years of relative stability, so we start to focus on other things, and then when things are difficult or when there are challenges, we're always looking for. We've been taught recently in recent history that you know, problems get solved by somebody else or somebody else is going to swoop in and deal with it. And I think that there are a lot of people that don't realize that, you know, they can determine the trajectory of their well-being and their prosperity.
Well, your book, Better to Win, how did that come to mind? To write this book, because I know what it's like to write a book. You take yourself away from family and friends, and it's just you and the paper. So what motivated you to get the book written?
Yeah, it probably was one of the scariest things I've ever done, because you don't know where to start. And, you know, a blank white page is probably terrifying to most people because there's no real template to it. But I did finish 30 years of working in the legislature and in campaigns, and I really was at a crossroads about, well, what did it all amount to? Did any of it matter? Because I felt that, you know, when you go camping, you should leave the campsite better than you found it.
Yes.
And I didn't really feel like the campsite was that much better than when I found it. In fact, I felt like it was worse. I was having a little bit of a crisis of faith. So, I was told, or I was, advice, well, why don't you just start writing down what you think you might have accomplished, and maybe it'll give you a better assessment. So that's kind of where it started. And then I really felt that we were at a inflection point, both as a democracy and both as an Asian American community, with regard to how do we deal with the current situation and what can we do, because there's a sense of helplessness, I think, that both in mainstream and in the Asian American community with regard to all the crazy things that are happening, like, what can we do? And I think political activism and my experience in the work that I did really had some great lessons about what you actually can do as just a normal person in this world to really, you know, stand up for yourself and stand up for other people.
Well, you also had a phrase in your prologue that I liked very much, too, if you could tell me more about it, which is the hunger game of merit, the hunger games of merit, I guess.
Yeah, I think that there, particularly as Asian Americans, we're always being told that you know, we're smart, and that if you just work hard, that you'll succeed, and then nobody will bother you. And I think in the last iteration, we see very clearly that you know, Asian American community members of the community have worked really hard, but they were subject to a lot of violence and hatred and resentment. And but the system kind of feeds you this narrative that just as long as you work hard and you keep quiet and you don't rock the boat, that you'll be fine. But that exact same complacency, not just for the Asian American community, but America as a whole, has kind of put us at a disadvantage with regard to individuals and organizations and agendas that want to take advantage of us. So we have to really look at, are we just chasing this ball, whether it's you know, mostly when I say merit too, it's like how it's aligned with status and safety and position in the world, and how we've become so addicted to trying to attain status, whether it's through wealth or, you know, those types of things, and whether or not that pulls us away from focusing on the things that are important in our community and our democracy.
Well, would being called the model minority fit into that too? Because that's always
Absolutely.
Bothered me, that phrase.
Yes. It's a horrible phenomenon or term that boxes Asian Americans in and uses it. It's used to denigrate other communities of color by juxtaposing this mythological Asian American stereotype against, you know, and the comparisons, you know, aren't apples to oranges. Everybody has a different experience, and you know, the Asian American experience is quite complex, and it also implies that there's a natural animosity or competitiveness between the Asian American community and other communities of color, which there is not. But I think that's a prevailing narrative that, you know, is meant to keep everybody busy and everybody at their throats, so that, you know, it's harder for the communities to unite and organize.
Well, I would think it would also force, the phrase would also force perfectionism onto the culture too. And that's a very tough thing to have weighing on anybody, to try to be perfect. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at suicide rates among Asian Americans and mental health issues, I mean, they're skyrocketing, and a lot of it's unreported, but you see the dysfunction as a result of these unrealistic expectations on that are created by this narrative. And I had so many friends that, you know, they did everything perfectly. They went to the right, you know, high school. They went to the right graduate school. They went to, you know, they became doctors and lawyers. And then somewhere in their 50s, they're like, I am the most unhappy person in the world.
Oh my.
And they decided to go be a chef, or they decided to, you know, garden or do other things that was completely unacceptable to the parents at the time. And they basically wasted that entire section of their life pursuing somebody else's you know, the definition of success.
Yes. Not a place anybody wants to find themselves in. And you talked about in your book, Better to Win, that you were just a child when you got the sense of principle-centered living and living by a code. And, you know, tell us about that childhood that ultimately led to your 30-year career in government.
Yeah, well, I mean, I talk about a television show that I'd watched.
I'm a Star Trekker too.
You know,
go ahead.
So I think that's one thing that's interesting now, actually, because really, and this is something that I've come to wonder is that in the most recent history, a lot of our stories are very dystopian, and the heroes aren't really, you know, everything is simplified. But when I was growing up, I watched a lot of Star Trek. I read a lot of comic books, and there was a hero narrative. There was like this right and wrong. There was about standing up for the little person or the underdogs or those types of things. So that really permeated my growing up. And it really influenced how I saw, you know, the kind of world order that if you, had great power, you also have great responsibility. And that really influenced what I wanted to do. I didn't know what exactly that meant, because obviously wasn't going to don a cape and a mask and go out there and be a vigilante. But public service and being a legislative staffer and working in that arena really gave me the opportunity to develop skills and then be able to exercise them in a way that I felt tangibly helped people.
Well, and you said, too, that you took the worst jobs, too, when you got started. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I took really menial jobs when I started in politics. And even before that, you know, I grew up in my parents' restaurant, and it was a small restaurant, and, you know, we struggled. But I think the experience really, I think when we think of success, we think of a certain thing, and we think of, you know, just having the best of everything, or the best education, only hanging out or spending time with the most, accomplished individuals. But what I really learned is that there's this just treasure trove of knowledge and wisdom and life experience from everyday people. When I waited on tables, I'd learned so much from customers that came in from all walks of life to the restaurant. When I was hanging out at the coffee machine with secretaries and schedulers and interns, other interns, I really learned quite a bit. And I really found that doing those types of, you know, kind of menial tasks and not just trying to be always focused on being power adjacent, like being next to the most important person in the room, or being, at events where only the important people were, really gave me a lot more depth and a lot more understanding and actually a lot more joy in life than the other, you know, spending time with powerful and wealthy individuals.
Well, in the subtitle of your book, Hardball Lessons in Leadership, Influence, and the Craft of Politics, you know, there's leadership versus character. And you talked about that. Characters, for me, character's what you do when no one is looking, right? It's just what's inside you. But what are your thoughts on leadership and character?
I really started to be disturbed by participating in a lot of panels for quote-unquote leadership programs that are out there, because, you know, I had accomplished some things in my career and I was asked to speak at these leadership things. And I really felt the conversation was, how did you become successful? Not how did you become a good person, or, you know, what really defines you as an individual, and, you know, what is your anchor to why you do the things you do? And all these leadership programs were really hyper-focused on the brass ring or the next title or the next accomplishment that, you know, would indicate that you've kind of made it as a leader and get to wear the mantle of leadership. And I really felt that that's a conversation that we really don't have, is the values and the characteristics of what a good leader should be. So I really wanted to write about the qualities, about having character, about you know, having empathy, and I wrote a story about one of the chapters discusses how the leader on my football team made an apology to a junior player, and he didn't do it as a theatrical effort. He did it out of sincerity, and it really had a tremendous impact on me about what it means to be a leader and how you should conduct yourself with the people that are on your team.
Well, it's, you know, this is a very big issue for me. We actually have a mutual friend, Martha Bulin, right? Mm-hmm. Martha helped me write my first book, too. She was my consultant. And in that book, I talked about anti-character. You know, we talk about character, but I really see people with anti-character. They know what's right and wrong. They know what they're supposed to be, truthful or trustworthy, and they don't do it anyway. You know, they're actually against character. I'm sure that's a basis of criminal behavior, but it seems to be pervasive in our society right now, and trying to get those values of character, what you were taught as a child or what you were taught in the working in your parents' restaurant, are basic skills. And it's, I learned from Dr. Wilford Jarvis many years ago, the difference, what he called who-ness and what-ness. And you talked about you know, a very good story about someone who's in the power suit and is at the front of the table. And, you know, that's all whatness, you know, where your position sitting in the table at a meeting, or the title you have, or the, or as you said, the accomplishments that you can tick off and tell people. But your who-ness is really that empathy and honesty and trustworthiness. And, you know, I'm worried that we're losing touch with all of that. Do you have any comments on what I just shared?
I absolutely agree, and I think that it's structural. There's an old indigenous story about, you know, this grandson is talking to his grandfather, and grandfather says, in each of us lies two wolves. There's one that is greedy and hateful and angry and bitter, and then there's one that is good and courageous and compassionate. And they're always at war. And the grandson says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, it's the one you feed.
It's the one you feed. Yes.
Yeah. I don't think our society really feeds that be a better person. I mean, I think that when I was growing up, I really had a lot of stuff on TV, teachers, everybody really wanted to create better people, not just successful people. And I think that we've kind of strayed away from that. And we just teach people how to succeed or how to get to the next thing. But we've lost. It's kind of like a dinner without any flavor, you know?
Oh, well said.
Stuff, right? Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, we still teach our children in kindergarten, you know, about honesty and fairness and thoughtfulness and caring for their friends. And somewhere along the line, we lose it. And I know that many of the universities now just teach what can get you the job, what can get you the money, and not
they're
really
by the Hunger Games of merit. Right?
The Hunger Game of merit. That's right. The Hunger Games of merit. So, you know, we, I guess, as individuals and on our families and your friend who had the baby, it's really on our shoulders to teach empathy, to teach honesty, to teach trustworthiness, even when it's difficult. And you talked about, just in your book and just recently now, about the power of an apology. And I think a lot of people are taught, don't apologize for anything. You know, don't say you're sorry for anything. And you experienced the power of the apology as well. Anyone really recognizes how important that is, right?
Absolutely.
To have that ability.
Mm-hmm. It's so unique of an ability, and it's so transformative. I actually, there is another story. I didn't put it in the book, but this was when Twitter was first starting out, and I posted something. It was from a Mike Myers, one of the Austin Power movies, about a fat person, and there was somebody who was offended by it. Huh. And you know, they responded, and I was like, initially in my head, I was like, come on, you know, I'm just, you know, it was like just a joke. But then I realized, oh, no, that's not right. So I actually responded to him, like, you're absolutely right. You know, you're 100% correct. You know, I'll take down the Twitter, the tweet, and I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the response from him was just amazing. It was like, oh, thank you. So, like, somebody heard him. And I benefited from that because I, it really taught me a huge lesson to be more thoughtful before I go out and tweet things, which I clearly is not the case with, you know, much of humanity right now. So, but yeah, it was again, a huge reminder about how important it is to own up to your mistakes.
I got so involved in this conversation. I want to go to a break. You are listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today asks, can you do good and defeat evil without power? And our guest is Bill Wong, who is an award-winning political strategist and author of Better to Win. You may reach Bill on Twitter at Bill Wong LLC and also visit bettertowin.com.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Tom Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
We're back. Would you like a friend to hear this interview on Can You Do Good and Defeat Evil Without Power? As you've heard by now, Be Bold America is available as a podcast and pushed out to 10 podcast platforms and also to YouTube. Subscribe for free from your favorite podcast platform. And we're speaking with Bill Wong. So, Bill, the next question I wanted to ask was, you know, how you felt about those who deride government. You've spent a career in government. I've spent a career in government. And, you know, Reagan's nine words that he said so many decades ago when he said, when somebody says, I'm from the government and I'm here to help, were the nine worst words he ever heard. It really hurt me because I was in the government and I really was there to help. How do you feel about those who deride government?
First, I think it's ironic for, you know, Ronald Reagan, who spent a career in government, to say that. I guess people don't appreciate the kind of inconsistency of him saying that and all the people that were in the circle that were involved in government. And I think that, you know, government has its flaws, but it also got tremendous benefit, and it plays a tremendous role with regard to making sure that the American society is protected. I mean, we don't have child labor because of government intervention, but you know, as obviously the recent news has, is that there are people trying to undermine that effort to ban child labor. You know, we have a 5-day work week, we have holidays, we have safety net healthcare services, we have quality free public education, which I benefited from. I was able to go to a very good university for almost free. And, you know, government does a tremendous amount of good things. And I think that there is a cottage industry for people to peddle the narrative that government is bad, and that if you just leave people to their own devices, everything will be fine. And that has never been proven to be the case with regard to the American society, that if you deregulate things always go bad.
Well, nothing good comes out of negative talk or austerity or deriding government. I mean, how do you make something good out of that? And I guess that does lead me to the name of the show. Can you do good without power?
I think it's almost impossible, but I think that also you have to understand what power you have and what we're talking about power, because some people may think that it's about wealth. And the biggest worry that I have when I said that was that, you know, people then just try to acquire power just for power's sake, or acquire, you know, wealth or access to resources just for the sake of it. And you really have to balance it out with having certain pillars of values that determine how you dedicate those resources, that power that you have. It's always liken it to fire. You could either cook your dinner or you could burn down the house. But it's up to the people that are handling the fire that determine, you know, what the fate is going to be.
So I see the arrow going right back to character again. You know, people having to walk the talk, having that, the living a principle-centered life, knowing what they stand for, right?
I absolutely believe so, but I think that the one scary thing now is that we can lead dual lives. So that the life that we live on social media that we put out there is one thing, and what we can do on a day-to-day basis is another. So we've almost, our society now has really encouraged this duality where they can be completely inconsistent. So you could go on Facebook and say, you know, I'm volunteering for this charity, but then be a really horrible person. I remember when we were going through some of the social upheaval after Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd thing, there were stories about these influencers that were showing up to these protests just to get selfies, and then they would just drive off in their Mercedes Benz. So they look like they cared, but they actually didn't, and they wanted to look like they were part of the movement, but they had really invested no time or effort into the movement. So there's this kind of fakeness that's out there that we really have to come to terms with as a society.
Well, the fakeness, I guess, would come under whatness. They wanted to look like they cared, the whatness part of
exactly.
it, but who they were, they really didn't. And that was very sort of an epiphany moment for me when you said we live dual lives. I, you know, being one way on, you know, one-to-one, person-to-person, our jobs, and then we're on social media. And that brought up for me another character issue, which is integrity. You know, integrity is being who you are everywhere you go. And not being somebody on social media. So integrity is another character issue that, I don't know, I think we're losing. We really need to talk about it. And I know I'm probably talking too much about it, but that's why I think it's so important, as we've lost living these principles day in and day out and carrying them over to our social media. Right?
Yeah, I think the challenge is that there's not enough day-to-day content that outweighs or overweights values and qualities like integrity or character. You know, I came from an era when all that type of stuff was talked about in everywhere you go, whether it's you're in high school or whether or not you're watching movies or reading comic books or even if you're going to church. But now everything is really about money and status, and everything that we get with regard to content now is about performance. It's about popularity. It's about very superficial things. So you're talking about how do you build a society when the majority of your content is focused on superficial aspects of the human condition, as opposed to really highlighting and lifting up these values and these qualities that you want in your neighbor, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, because I know a lot of Republicans that really care about, you know, the society, really care about doing the right things, just as, you know, Democrats do. And I also know that there are performative people on both sides of the aisle. So, you know, instead of trying to divide us up on things, you know, maybe we find the bright spots that are there with people who really are willing to make the sacrifices necessary in order to make our society a better place.
Well, you're really right, because it seems the direction our society is going, which you just mentioned about money and status and popularity, again, is on the whatness. Nothing is developing the internal side of things. I took and was a facilitator for many years on the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And Dr. Stephen Covey had the model of a iceberg. And, you know, an iceberg, you see the little tip of the iceberg out of the water, and that's what you see in a person. That could be somebody's whatness, you know, that title, the how much money they make, the status. But the big part of the iceberg that you don't see is your character. And I think we've got it all upside down. So let's take a break right now before I ask you another big question. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. And we're speaking with our bold guest, Bill Wong, who is an award-winning political strategist and author of Better to Win, Hardball Leadership, Influence, and the Craft of Politics. You may reach Bill on Twitter at Bill Wong LLC or visit bettertowin.com. We will be right back after Jim Hightower's commentary titled, How Perverse is the GOP's Book Banning Crusade?
Tiptoeing around the democratic process, Indiana's Republican legislature has become the latest of that ilk to slap its local school librarians with an idiotic book ban. Snuck into law behind closed doors, the partisan Hoosier law requires librarians to pull books that the learned lawmakers consider, quote, harmful to minors. Just to juice up the ignorance and arrogance of their ban, the law criminalizes failure to comply by punishing librarians with up to 2.5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. What constitutes harmful to minors? Indiana's priggish politicians declared nudity, sexual references, and offensive content to community standards to be violations. Obviously, then, books commanding that rape victims marry their rapists, as well as celebrating daughters who seduce their father to bear his children, plus endorsement of bestiality, copulation in church, women boiling their children for food, and so god-awful much more, have to be ripped from the shelves and burned. Only all of this is enshrined in the Bible, which is urged on Indiana's youngsters in Sunday schools, conveniently placed in the bedstands of every chain hotel and cited by pious lawmakers as their moral compass. The so-called good book is replete with the gross and explicit sexual material that Republican book censors call harmful. Indeed, a feisty civil libertarian organization named Freedom From Religion Foundation gives away book labels you can stick in Bibles, warning that, quote, literal belief in this book may endanger your health and life. This is Jim Hightower saying, the books that right-wing autocrats want to ban are not pornographic. They just explore ideas that those politicians don't like, ideas that young people are already grappling with. And by the way, why not require these pious lawmakers to disclose what licentious material they've been reading before they dictate what we read? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
We're back. My guest today is Bill Wong, author of Better to Win. Now, Bill, before I ask you another big question, did you any thoughts come up for you about book banning? I know that a lot of book banning has been happening with topics on minority culture issues. Are you aware of anything like that in the AAPI community?
I am. I don't remember exactly some of the books, but there has come up in the community, and I think that it's driven by a strategy of us, you know, that is driving some of the Republican agenda. Because I don't think that all Republicans believe in book banning. I think that this is a way to create an environment of pitting communities against each other, having the conversation be about culture wars instead of the economy, instead of the climate crisis. It's a way to distract us from really issues that you know are an immediate threat to our well-being by creating these divisions and keeping us occupied by being at each other's throats, or the perception that there is some type of race war that's going on. And I think that it's being perpetrated by people who profit from the division. It's the same as people who profit from wars, that they're like arms dealers, and they create these narratives that allow them to raise a tremendous amount of money from individuals that are terrified of what they feel is as a loss of their own culture because of other cultures. They're basically exploiting people that are out there by creating these types of divisive fears.
Yeah, that was so well said. And let's look at this shiny object over here. While yes, we don't have any policy or ability to govern over there, but don't look at that. Look over here at this shiny object. And also the phrase divide and conquer comes to mind too. As long as we allow ourselves, no matter what community of heritage you're from, as long as we allow ourselves to be divided, I think those with money and those that are making money from it will continue. So we have to be very vigilant about when we're being manipulated like that. Go ahead.
In Florida, there's actually a situation where DeSantis passed a law to put Asian American stories into curriculum, but then banned stories about African Americans and Latinos. So that is a very specific attempt to pit communities against each other.
Very specific, and also probably setting up the Asian American community as the model minority again. Here, you're in our legislation, but not you people over there. It's just, I get so angry. So you had a chapter on vision. And you had a phrase called turning the dots into inches. How does one look for the dots to turn into inches? And tell us more about the importance of vision.
I think it's critical because we're in a society where we think the answers are just there. Like, you know, you'll just trip over it, or because everything that we have is, if you want a meal, you just go one place and it's all done. Or you just go on the internet and you just find things. Answers are easy, but for complex problems, answers aren't easy, and sometimes you have to connect the dots with regard to how to solve those questions or those problems that you face. And this is something that has been said by Steve Jobs and many of the great minds of our time, is that it's not going to be necessarily immediately apparent, and you have to work at it a little bit, and you also have to look at all of the little aspects. And that's why I also think it's so important, because in our world, we think that the solutions are with the wealthiest, most powerful people, and sometimes they're not. So when we're looking at trying to solve these problems, we can't just look to the authority figures. We have to look within ourselves and with individuals who you may have overlooked or may have a great idea or may play a significant place, a role in a very specific place that is the that's going to be the solution to the problems. And what I think about most important is that means you can't take anybody for granted. You can't say that these people are important and then these people are not important just because of who they are, because they could be the source of your solution. And that's happened time and time again in history, is that some of the solutions to some of our biggest problems at the time came from very unlikely individuals. For example, the United States moon landing was facilitated by black women who did the math with regard to how to accomplish that mission.
And yes.
In the time, nobody would have thought that was the case. You would have just thought that it would have been some, you know, white mathematician that would have done it. But, you know, and at the time, they were under a lot of discrimination. So, like, their bathrooms weren't even in the same building. So,
right.
You know, we overlook the keys to our salvation every day.
Also, just to dovetail on what you were talking about with vision, is that for me, is it a constructive and compelling and creative vision, or is it a destructive, repelling, disruptive vision? I mean, Newt Gingrich said many years ago that they wanted the Republican Party, they wanted one-party rule. Now, we have a two-party system, so that to me is a destructive vision. Or many people want to keep others from voting. That is they have a vision, and they've had, well, Paul Weyrich said in the 70s that they don't want everybody to vote. So that's been a long-term vision, but it is a negative, destructive vision. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, everybody assumes we're talking about vision as being a positive one and a progressive one and one that's good for all. But there are those that don't share that vision, right?
Yeah, but I also think that it's more so, I guess, a case of narrow vision versus broad vision and context.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
I think it's hilarious that Newt Gingrich says that, because in California we have basically one-party rule.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that he would ever support one-party rule in, in California.
Very good point.
I think that... You know, he was very specific about he wanted one-party rule of Republicans.
Which party? Right.
So,
his party.
Exactly. And that's always what dictators utilize, is like they want to use something that is sounds good, but then for nefarious reasons of twisting it to their advantage. And I think that's why it's important for people to read more books, to get more perspectives. It's one. It's important for me to talk to a lot of Republicans, and Republicans, not just the ones that I deal with in Sacramento or the Capitol, but also the ones that are like in neighborhoods. Like, I walked a lot of Republican neighborhoods, and you find out that, you know, the more you talk to people, the more you broaden their vision, the more they broaden my vision, the better solutions that we have. So when people are trying to restrict your vision, just look at things from a black and white standpoint, or, you know, a yes or no or good or bad standpoint, they're really trying to erase out the context and the broader, you know, perspective that may give you a better solution to the challenge that you're facing.
You know, I just want to make sure I shift to a chapter that you wrote that I thought was really unique. And that was your chapter on the shark fin ban. It was fascinating. You were caught between your Chinese cultural, you know, heritage and the significance of the shark fin soup at banquets and the Chinese philosophy of harmony with the environment. So this issue really represented something much bigger than the shark fin ban, right?
Absolutely. It's, you know, a big part of it is giving a community its self-determination to provide greater context, provide a more complex view instead of just portraying us as interested in soup. You know, we're much more complex for that. And I would have been as happy to lose that battle as to win that battle, because I really wanted us to have the conversation that made us more complex with regard to understanding the priorities that we struggle with, like every community struggles with. Yeah, you know, it's a iconic cultural aspect of our culture, of our, you know, community's events and celebrations. But at the same time, there are other aspects of our community that supersede that. So, you know, we as a community, we want to take control of that narrative and say, you know, we're willing to take control over that and express that, yeah, that was part of our culture, but we also think that harmony with nature and saving the environment is more important than this one cultural aspect of our identity.
So for those of us who don't know the results of that, the shark fin ban went into law?
It did. It was signed by Governor Jerry Brown. It had a tremendous amount of support from the Asian American and Chinese American community. And there was some opposition from the Chinese American and Asian American community as well. But it was signed into law after a very, very challenging legislative struggle where we were outspent and outnumbered in some ways in our efforts. But we managed to win that fight, and shark fin is banned. The sale of and trade of shark fin in California is banned. And the reason why it was so important is because California is one of the largest markets for shark fin at the time. And by banning it, we reduced the demand on shark fin and therefore reduced the shark finning that was occurring in the international seas. And what happened recently was that the United States government has also passed a ban on shark fin. So it just kind of caught fire, and it now has just taken precedence on a national basis.
And the Chinese community has, you know, accepted and supported that and support the environmental importance of that, correct?
Just, yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, the national effort was supported by Chinese-American members of Congress, and I think there are still some that are, you know, that feel, you know, opposed to it, and then some people that don't have a focus on the environment. But you're always going to have the case where, you know, some people continue to believe in that cultural aspect of our community and over the climate concerns that we've had. But, you know, nobody's ever going to be 100% all on board. But, you know, those victories definitely show that there's momentum and a change in perspective where it has enough support to be able to be passed into law.
That's right. It's very hard to let go of a tradition like that. It's a very important tradition. In the description of your book, you talk about the mindset and machinery involved in the use of power and the sacrifices necessary to effect meaningful change. What did you mean by sacrifices?
I think somebody, I can't remember who said it, but anything can be accomplished if who got credit didn't matter. And I think that those, you know, that's what I really wanted to talk about is that when we're doing this work, and a predominant amount of the times that I did my work, it was in the background, so I never got credit for things, and that was totally fine. But I think that, you know, we're in a moment where people always have to have credit, or people have to be at the front of the parade, and that really prevents us from taking a step back. And then also, you know, having to be the winner all the time means that we're never going to compromise. And you know, I disagree with a lot of people, but ultimately, you know, we all have to live together, and I think that we have to make certain compromises, but that comes from, you know, really genuine discussions and being able to come to the table and be willing to let go of certain things that you know, we may think are important, but the bigger picture is much more important.
Well, it's time for a break, but I want to follow up on what else you wanted to talk about, too, after the break. If you are just joining us, my bold interview guest is Bill Wong, an award-winning political strategist and author of Better to Win, Hardball Leadership, Influence, and the Craft of Politics. You may reach Bill on Twitter at Bill Wong LLC, and also visit BetterToWin.com. You are listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Join KSQD this evening at 6 for Tackling the Taboo Sunday Dinner. Mark Gardner welcomes Georgia Iluno, intern with the Roots of Traditional Foods and Cultural Practices program at UCSC, to look at issues affecting mental health and wellness for BIPOC communities. And Alexis Rodriguez talks about Earth Day, the Seymour Marine Biology Center, and drag shows. That's this evening from 6 until 7 here on KSQD, 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station.
We're back. Well, Bill, we have a few more minutes here, and I had prepared so many questions. I've sort of been not letting you talk about what else you want to cover in your book. So what were some other key things you wanted to cover before I get back to my list of questions?
I think the only real thing was that the point of the book was to try to be optimistic and to try to let people know that there are ways to be better, to learn how to campaign, learn how to take your own power and to make change in the world. Because I think that right now everybody just thinks it's hopeless, that government's not listening or nobody's listening and everything is broken. And yeah, it looks pretty grim, but we've been here before and we've been able to dig out before with the, you know, determination and perseverance of good people.
Well, I think you're right. This is, I think 2024 is very pivotal. And I think many people are taking their power back and knowing that they have it. I think you're, and you talked about campaigning. I do remember you saying that you love staying in the bad hotels and eating day-old food, and that it was especially fun. Why was that?
You know, if you read a story or you watched a TV show where everything was perfect, it would be a very boring TV show, right? It's all of these really crazy experiences and kind of hijinks and just, you know, disastrous situations that make life really interesting and give your life a lot of flavor and interest. And I think that that's what really I enjoy, is that I've been able to, I guess they say that, you know, may you lead an interesting life is kind of a blessing that people say from time to time. And I've led a very interesting life. And if everything was perfect and if everything was easy, I think I'd be just a horribly boring person.
Well, you're not boring, and the book isn't boring either. I thought it was brilliant. And I did want to get, you know, even a little more serious, in that I would like, you talked about the disturbing years with Donald Trump and the MAGA-fueled anti-Asian racism, and I'd like to hear about how painful it was, how the anti-American racism that's being used by the MAGA movement and Donald Trump, you know, how this hate-filled belief still is affecting the AAPI community. What was your personal experience? How is it still affecting the community?
You know, my personal experience was just watching this from the political standpoint and almost watching the train wreck happen in slow motion, because as I came up through politics, I'd studied the internment of Japanese Americans and studied the Chinese Exclusion Act and all of the other types of politically driven hatred toward Asian Americans, and to see it happen all again. And, you know, when I was going through college, a young Chinese American man was murdered in Detroit, Vincent Chin, because of all of the economic rhetoric about Japanese automakers taking American jobs. And Vincent was a Chinese American, so I knew the minute that the rhetoric was starting to come through that somebody was going to get hurt. And mm-hmm. sure enough, hate crimes rose 1,000%. People were killed. There were deaths. There were attacks, physical attacks, where people were maimed and injured, seriously injured. And to watch that happen and not being able to stop it was just terrifying. And it continues to this day. In fact, one of the recent shootings was very specifically the one that happened at the Texas Mall. The person was yes. heavily anti-Asian, had a lot of anti-Asian propaganda, and that led to the deaths of children. And that's the situation we're on because of the lack of responsibility of these individuals who are peddling that type of hatred from a political standpoint.
Well, it terrifies me, too. And, You use the phrase in your chapter on the margin of victory that you burn with rage. And I feel that I sometimes burn with rage, too, at such the manipulation and injustice and how we've abandoned this country to guns and won't do anything about it. Since we honor our AAPI Americans this month, can you share, you know, how you burn with rage and how you turn that into constructive and creative ways to campaign and to help California and the Asian community?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I mean, it's very salient. I think, you know, that rage, and this doesn't just apply to Asian Americans, but right now, Americans who have rage, they express it through social media, and, you know, they post their rage, and that's, to a certain extent, important to be able to express it, but it doesn't really help. If you have rage, if you're angry about what's wrong with America right now, then go out there and register people to vote. Go out there and volunteer on a campaign. Go out there and donate to candidates who are running for office that share your beliefs. Go out there and volunteer. You know, for Asian Americans, what we have to do is we have to get more engaged in the political world. I mean, we've, for the most part, and as a student of Asian American politics, we haven't been in the game. And we're only now starting to elect representatives to be at the table who can address these types of issues at the table and not be at the mercy of other people representing us. And that has to increase more. They have to donate more. They are the wealthiest sub-ethnic group in the United States. They have the highest, you know, individual household net worth that's out there that they're not maximizing by supporting candidates that can be their voice at the table. They could be spending a lot more time in supporting, you know, candidates that support their beliefs and perspectives and that will defend the Asian American community. For example, in California, we have, I think, 14 Asian American members of the state legislature, and they passed a $167 million budget allocation to fight anti-Asian hate in the state.
Wonderful.
That's the largest amount allocated in the entire United States by any state.
Wow. Great job.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Well, and just to before I get into the, you know, what we could keep doing, stop doing, start doing to support your work and what you cover in your book, I do have one sort of more lighthearted question. One of your tips in the book was for people to look around the office because that tells you who that person is. What does it mean for someone who has rubber duckies all around her office? I'm just talking about a friend.
I think it tells you a lot. I think it tells you that there's a certain amount of creativity and whimsy. There's a certain empathy that's there. And obviously somebody who is very visually oriented because the image of duckies are, and I have several myself, you know, are very amusing from a visual standpoint. So it tells you that that person is not overly serious, not overly walled off, and is open to an optimistic perspective.
And always appreciative when her coworkers, my friend's coworkers, brought some to add to the collection. Now that she's retired, she loves to say she has all her ducks in a row. Anyway, just wanted to lighten up things a bit. So what can we do? What can we keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to support your work and your book?
I think that the key thing is there's two things. One is it's not just about knowing. It's not just about being right. It's about action. It's about, you know, participating on a daily basis. And even if it's a little bit, even if you, like, you know, just spend one weekend helping a candidate or, you know, spend one weekend phone banking or, you know, just write one check, it all matters. But you have to exercise it in a physical or, you know, substantive type of thing. Because I think that, you know, we complain to our friends, we complain on social media, and we think that we're done. No, you have to go a little bit further, and you only get these skills from practicing it. You only understand and can observe a candidate when you're out there walking a precinct with him or her on the campaign. And so to actually do it in action items as opposed to just taking a position. And then secondly, the more you understand human beings, you know, like this whole rubber ducky thing, the more you'll be able to communicate with people and meet them where they're at. And you're the, everybody is the bridge to somebody else. So even if you think this person's going to be intransigent with their beliefs, you'd be surprised. You know, I grew up in a very rural area, and I found a lot of places to find common ground with my Republican colleagues. And, you know, and they were not contrary to my own personal beliefs. In fact, a lot of times they were just aligned, but they were just said differently. But that's not going to happen unless you try to learn as much as you can from them, so that they can also have the opportunity to learn from you.
Are there things that we should stop doing?
Get off social media.
Yes.
I mean, it's all a distraction. And, you know, we have to be really conscious about all the distractions that are intentionally out there to prevent us from being able to focus on the things that matter. You know, it's you know, the quality of entertainment is low. It's just, you know, you just get onto doom scrolling and you're just consuming enormous amounts of emotional and mental energy by inadvertently consuming. It's kind of like all those hidden calories that are in potato chips. It's like before you know it, you've eaten an entire bag of potato chips because you can't stop. And I think that that's preventing us from having a healthy society is all of the kind of junk food that we have out there with regard to content and, online activity.
And the wormhole you can go down into and the loss of time that all takes as well. And what should we start doing?
Talking to real people, you know, your neighbors, you know, the reading. I think reading is one of the undervalued things that are out there. But, you know, really just human interaction and trying to learn as much as you can, even if it's on issues and topics that you're not comfortable with.
Well, I love the line, your power is already in you. Now that you know, it's up to you to believe it and wield it on behalf of the powerless. So, Bill, thank you so much for being our bold and impressive interview guest today. I'm so grateful for your time. And I'm also very grateful for your insights on the Asian American community. That was so enlightening. Thank you for joining us on Be Bold America today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. What's next on Be Bold America? Please join us on Sunday, June 4th on Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Economic hitmen are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. On Be Bold America, we have the honor of interviewing New York Times bestselling author John Perkins on his famous book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In this third edition, John blows the whistle on China's economic hitman strategy, exposes corruption on an international scale, and offers much-needed solutions for curing the global death economy. However, all is not lost. John also provides a source of hope for transforming the death economy into a life economy, and he will inspire us to participate in a new era of global cooperation. Don't miss Confessions of an Economic Hitman and join Be Bold America on Sunday, June 4th at 5 p.m. As a reminder, Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you may listen to the show anytime for free by subscribing through your favorite podcast platforms such as Apple, Google, and Spotify. I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Eliza James, and to our station's program director, Howard Feldstein. You are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online. Stay tuned for Tackling the Taboo. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.